From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Barbara Slavin, Acting Director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. Joining me on the show this week are David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor at National Journal. And here are the issues. After only 24 days on the job, Michael Flynn was forced to resign as White House National Security Advisor. The White House said trust in Flynn had eroded after he deceived officials about the content of calls with the Russian ambassador after the November 8 election. President Trump hosted Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at the White House. Trump urged Netanyahu to cut back slightly on settlement construction and said that either a one-state or a two-state solution with the Palestinians would be fine. The older half-brother of North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un was assassinated at an airport in Malaysia. The murder, by poison, occurred a few days after North Korea tested a ballistic missile. Tom, lots to talk about. Michael Flynn, tip of the iceberg, shades of Watergate. Why did he go, and where is this going to lead?
Where is it going to lead? It's a little unclear, although he has set a new record for lack of longevity for national security advisors, 24 days. This reminds me of the Reagan administration, where President Reagan went through six national security advisors, but his first one lasted for a year.
Yeah, Dick Allen, right?
Richard Allen. But clearly, this is a big blow to President Trump. You don't lose your national security advisor 24 days into an administration without there being some problem. The most benign construction you can put on it is that Flynn lied to Vice President Pence about his contacts with the Russian ambassador to the United States. That's the most benign construction. Critics are wondering whether he was having all these multiple conversations with the ambassador at President Trump's behest. And if that is true, what were they talking about? And where's the president's knowledge here? It's a little murky, but it's clearly embarrassing, and there's more here that needs to be sorted out.
Yeah. David, this whole question of the Trump campaigns and Trump's relationship with Russia is one that remains really confusing to a lot of people. President Trump had a rather wild press conference recently where he again defended the idea of a better relationship between the United States and Russia. He even blamed the media, in a sense, for stirring up controversy about this and making it difficult for him to have a better relationship with Russia. What is behind this, and will the various investigations into Flynn and so on begin to uncover some of this?
So I think we need to take a step back and just remind readers, why did Mike Flynn just have to resign as national security advisor, so the top national security kind of coordinator, referee, arbiter within the White House, a very powerful figure, one of the most powerful jobs inside the White House. Essentially, during the election, listeners will remember that emails from senior officials in the Clinton campaign and at the Democratic Party headquarters were stolen and leaked onto the internet by WikiLeaks, and that during the campaign, at the very end, American intelligence chiefs in the last days of the Obama government said that they were sure that this was a Russian intelligence operation ordered at the highest levels of the Russian government. So just after the election, in December, in the very final days of Barack Obama's time in the White House, the American government decided to punish Russia with sanctions specifically for the offense, the hostile act of attempting to interfere and meddle in American democracy. That's a very, very serious event, an assault on American democracy by a hostile foreign power. What General Flynn, the man who's just resigned, did was phone the Russian ambassador on the same day that Barack Obama's team punished Russia and said, "Don't worry, this punishment will go away soon. We're going to be taking over in a couple of weeks' time, and then we can start having a better relationship." Now that's, I would argue, an extraordinarily disloyal act for any American.
Yeah, we have one president at a time.
We have one president at a time, and he was saying, "You are being punished for an assault on American democracy. We don't care about that assault on American democracy, and we're going to make sure that punishment goes away." The extraordinary thing about the press conference, and there were a long list of extraordinary things about that press conference, is that when journalists really pushed President Trump on whether Mike Flynn was in the right or the wrong to have had that conversation, his answer was basically, he should have done that. He was doing the right thing. So he wanted him to have that conversation with the Russian ambassador.
He probably told him to have that conversation.
And so President Trump's big complaint is not that General Flynn went around the back of an American government and reassured the Russians they wouldn't be punished for a hostile act. His big grievance and complaint is that it got out that that's what happened, yeah, is that the press revealed that that's what happened with the help of the American intelligence services. So he's not fussed about the crime.
No.
He's angry that his cover-up didn't work. There is one final thing, I think, which is really extraordinary. It's, you know, we have to try and keep track of all the extraordinary things. Where the president has a point is that it is absolutely stunning that the reason that General Flynn had to resign and that the press got this story is that the American intelligence services were leaking information against the new elected president of America. That is, you know, we're used to that happening in places like Turkey. We're used to that happening in places like Central Asia. This is not normal in America. This is not at all a normal moment in America.
Yeah. Well, Tom, of course, this results from the dysfunctional relationship between Trump that started during the campaign and the American intelligence agencies. I mean, he was denigrating them. He was reminding people of the mistakes they made in Iraq. And, you know, the fact that we are where we are, there were other reports suggesting that he is not getting full and complete intelligence briefings, that he's getting kind of watered down cartoonish versions with no nuance and lots of maps there. Of course, he has his own CIA director now, and he will have a director of national intelligence, so we'll see if this settles down. But I think what's most alarming is this sense that, at least in national security terms, the United States is kind of adrift right now.
Just before the inauguration of President Trump, I was having lunch with an old friend who, if Hillary Clinton had been elected, would be a very senior national security advisor. And he says, I have one piece of advice for President-elect Trump. Don't pick a fight with the intelligence agencies. They fight back hard and they're nasty. So that sounded like pretty good advice to me, but the then President-elect Trump didn't take it, and now they are fighting back. I mean, one thing that Mr. Trump has said at his press conference that is true is these leaks are criminal acts. This is classified information. The problem is he seems more interested in going after the leakers, which he has every right to do. Mm-hmm. President Obama did the same thing, but he seems far less interested in getting to the bottom of what was going on with the Russians and whether or not agents of his were dealing with members of Russian intelligence during the campaign, which has been alleged now.
Yeah. Now, David, let's go back to the initial issue, though. What is it about Russia and Vladimir Putin that is so appealing to President Trump? We've had President Trump say extraordinary things suggesting a moral equivalence between the United States and Russia in an interview with Fox News. What is it?
So that's an extremely good question. I was just in Europe, in London, but also in Brussels at NATO headquarters, asking people exactly that question. Now, are there elements of kind of financial kind of shenanigans that explain some of his reticence? I don't know. And it's very troubling that we don't know. And one reason we don't know is that he has not released his tax returns, which is shocking and wrong. But on the ideological front, there is, if you talk to people in the Trump team, a belief that the single biggest problem facing America today, and indeed the whole of what they call the kind of Judeo-Christian West, is the rise of radical Islam. And that the reason that radical Islam has been allowed to spread so far is that people like Barack Obama or European governments are weak and soft and worried about human rights, and worried about being too kind of kind, and that what you need is an iron fist, and you need to smash it down as hard as you can and as often as you can. And their view, I think, which is, I would argue, a very dangerous and unsophisticated view, is that Russia is essentially willing to use an iron fist to smash down on radical Islam where you find it. And so you look at a civil war like Syria, the American government under Barack Obama looked at that and said that Russia was playing an essentially very unhelpful role in Syria, that the Russian government claimed to be fighting terrorists but was in fact just propping up the dictatorship of Bashar Assad, that the Russian government was dropping bombs indiscriminately, did not care about civilian casualties, did not care about human rights abuses. Team Trump looks at that same Russian conduct in Syria. Those same dumb bombs dropping without any guidance onto civilian areas. And they think that's the only language those savages understand. Russia is a good ally. We should work with Russia. And in order to secure Russian help in places like Syria, we should be willing to give up lots of concessions on things that Russia wants in, say, Eastern Europe, and basically say to Vladimir Putin, you have a sphere of influence in your former sort of neighbours that we're just not going to kind of fuss about what happens in Crimea and happens in Ukraine. This is terrifying to European allies and to NATO allies of America. They think it's the worst possible policy. But it does seem to be this view that you need someone who will smash radical Islam with a sort of mailed fist.
Yeah. Let's go back, Tom, to what happens next. Flynn is under investigation by the FBI. The Senate Intelligence Committee has its own investigation into, you know, the links, whatever they may have been, between the Trump campaign and Russia. New York Times now is calling for a special prosecutor. Again, shades of Watergate. Where do you think this is going procedurally?
Well, the White House will resist a special prosecutor. They don't want to. They don't want the Republicans to lose oversight here. The Senate Intelligence Committee is chaired by a senator from North Carolina named Richard Burr, who does not have a reputation for being the brightest bulb in the fixture. So the Democrats are saying the Republicans want to slow walk this process. On the other hand, you have prominent Republican senators like John McCain, Lindsey Graham, and now I think Senator Bob Corker, chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, who is saying this is a real threat to American democracy and we have to go after it hard. So I think there will be more. While the House Republicans seem to be willing to shrug their shoulders about this, I think the Senate Republicans are more interested in an investigation. So I think there will be one, which will, of course, will distract from the agenda that President Trump wants to do. But there's not much he can do about that.
We'll be back in just a minute. First, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Barbara Slavin of El Monitor, and joining me today are Tom DeFrank of National Journal and David Rennie of The Economist. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. The program is also available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. David, I want to say a little bit more about the press conference that occurred the other day, because it was so extraordinary. Trump obviously wanted to defend his administration, to say that he had accomplished more in barely a month than anyone else. He said, "I don't think there's ever been a president elected who in this short period of time has done what we've done." I think that's probably true. He also said this administration is running like a fine-tuned machine. Just your general reflections on the tenor and tone of that whole encounter. It lasted over an hour with the press.
So basically, President Trump turns out to be pretty much the same man as candidate Trump. I mean, I don't think anyone can say that we didn't know that this was what's just been elected. You would hope that being elected president of America would make you a bit more magnanimous, a bit more focused on big issues, and a bit less focused on, you know, how clever you were to get elected. There is a real sense, I think, and this is not making a partisan point about whether his policies are the right policies or the wrong policies. I watched that press conference with a lot of others. My sense was this is a man who is not grappling with the enormous job that he has. His comfort zone is to constantly talk about how he won the election, to go back to fighting old fights about debates a year ago with Hillary Clinton, to boast about the size of his victory. That was what made him happy. He's a reality TV star who is in love with the idea of the audience size, the ratings, the success, the show, the noise, the publicity. The business of being an American president, and Tom has watched so many American presidents up close, it is a relentless, exhausting, unbelievably difficult job. And he doesn't, to me, look like a man who is enjoying that job or has any real desire to engage with that job. He's still happier being a candidate. And, you know, he announced after that press conference that the weekend coming up, he was going to go to Florida
for a campaign rally.
What he called a campaign rally. And you can see that's his comfort zone, is cheering crowds and slogans and waves of applause.
Yeah. What did you think, Tom? Well, you said it brought back some memories.
Well, I had a flashback, Barbara. I can't remember a press conference so defensive by a president since the famous Richard Nixon press conference to newspaper editors in Orlando, Florida, in and I believe it was 1973, maybe 1974. And I was there, and it was late on a Saturday night, so it didn't get a lot of coverage. But at one point, in response to a question, Nixon said, "The American people have a right to know if their president is a crook." Well, I am not a crook.
Yeah.
And I still remember that. Well, I mean, nobody's accusing President Trump of being a crook, but the tone of this extraordinary press conference, and I was there also at this press conference, just was an extraordinary tone. It went on for an hour and 17 minutes, and to his credit, I thought he would filibuster about his record, which he did in a 24-minute monologue, but then he went and took over 20 questions. And
which is good.
I think it's absolutely good. Many people got a chance, not just his hand-picked sycophants, some of whom were in the briefing room, but he mentioned Hillary Clinton 12 times.
Yeah.
As David said, that's his comfort zone. He said he inherited a huge mess and he was fixing it. And at one point he said, "I'm really not a bad person." I mean, it was really kind of all about him. And I do think the whole notion when he said all these stories in the media about chaos in the White House are just made up fake news because we're a fine-tuned machine. You know, sometimes, we've discussed this before, sometimes it's too easy to get a story. And one of the easiest stories to get in this town these days is the story that the chaos in the Trump White House is unbelievable. And you know it's got some resonance when you're hearing this from Republicans. You expect Democrats to say it's the gang that can't shoot straight, they don't know what they're doing, they have too many power centers, which they do in the White House. But when Republicans, who obviously don't want to go on the record and say this, say they've never dealt with such chaos in a White House run by a president of their own party, then you know it's not fake news, it's real news.
Yeah, well, we could talk about where this is going in terms of domestic issues, but I wanted to talk about some important foreign news. The Israeli Prime Minister, Bibi Netanyahu, came to the White House, and there certainly he got a reception that he appeared to appreciate, very different from the mood music when Barack Obama was in the White House. And the president said, in response to a question, something rather amazing, which sort of seemed to toss over decades of U.S. policy. He was asked about whether the United States or whether he supports a one-state or a two-state solution for Israel and the Palestinians. And he basically said, "I don't care. Either one's fine. And, you know, whatever they want's fine with me." A day later, a U.N. ambassador came out and said, "No, we still support a two-state solution." So what was that all about?
So basically, the gigantic shift that we saw this week was, for 8 years, President Barack Obama had really terrible, icy, suspicious relations, personal political relations with Benjamin Netanyahu. And towards the end of the Obama term, officials would say more or less openly that they thought that Benjamin Netanyahu was the problem, that he was a political coward who was unwilling to confront the zealots on the sort of the far hard right in Israel and had just a misjudgment about what was in Israel's long-term interests. And so the stronger Benjamin Netanyahu was, the worse things were likely to get. Then you turn that 180 degrees with the arrival of President Trump, night and day, black and white. Their view is that the best thing to do for peace, or in general, is to strengthen Benjamin Netanyahu, to give him what he wants. And the language that President Trump used in that press conference either was or might as well have been drafted by Benjamin Netanyahu's office. And we know that Stephen Bannon, the chief ideological advisor to the president, is very close to one of Netanyahu's kind of absolute closest advisors on this, Ron Dermer, the Israeli ambassador to America. And essentially, President Trump gave the Israeli prime minister absolutely everything that he wanted. Because what Netanyahu needed to arrive with was to say back home in Israel, "I have this fantastic close relationship. This man is going to give me what I want, but he's not going to give me a completely free hand. He's going to be a little bit concerned about not building too many new settlements in the West Bank." And actually, some people said, "Ooh, you know, that's Trump rebuking the Israelis." That was what Netanyahu needed, because he's in this coalition government with people who are even more to the right than he is, who are saying to him that they want to annex chunks of the West Bank, that they want to give up completely on any idea ever of a Palestinian state. And so for Bibi Netanyahu to go home to Israel and say, "Actually, we have to be careful that we can't just do everything that we want, but he's pretty close to my line," it was the dream visit for Benjamin Netanyahu.
You know, Tom, reminds me a little bit of when George W. Bush was the president. There was also then a very, very strong embrace, first of Ariel Sharon and then those that followed Ariel Sharon. And, you know, there were concessions. There was a famous letter which said that the Israelis could continue to build homes for settlers, but they had to be within existing settlements, that sort of thing. Of course, that didn't work. There was an effort by the Arabs. There was, in 2002, an Arab initiative where basically they said, if you can reach a deal with the Palestinians, all the Arab countries will recognize Israel and so on. Trump seemed to be unaware of all these efforts in the past that didn't work. So why should this work now, or is it just something to say?
I think it was just something to say. I couldn't agree more with David about Netanyahu getting everything he wanted from Trump. The other thing he got was a very strong denunciation of Iran.
Of course.
General Flynn, before his demise, had a press statement on camera. It said, we're putting Iran on notice, and there are some new sanctions on Iran by the U.S., unilateral sanctions, and I think there are going to be more to come, and all of that is music to Netanyahu's ears as well.
Yeah. As we get all caught up in American politics, we sometimes forget that some incredible things are happening overseas, Tom. This one would normally have been front page news in the United States, if not for the Flynn resignation, firing, and all the investigations and so on going on here, and that is that Kim Jong-nam, 45 years old, the older half-brother of the North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un, was walking through the airport in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, on his way to get a flight back to Macau, where he has lived for some time. Several women came up to him. One of them sprayed him with something, which turned out to be a poison of some sort. And he died. There have been arrests. It seems pretty clear now that this was an assassination that was carried out on the orders of his half-brother. Yeah.
Well, Kim Jong-un is a crazy person.
Is he crazy, or is this just the way politics are run in that country?
Well, I mean, he's paranoid. Whatever he is dangerous. I think this validates something that President Obama told President-elect Trump in their first meeting 2 days after the election. Trump has said, I really learned some interesting things in that conversation with President Obama, including one thing that really surprised me. That was Obama saying to Trump, the biggest threat you have in the world right now is North Korea.
Yeah.
And whatever else this was, ancient enmities, is a reminder that Kim Jong-un is unstable. He is paranoid, and he has nuclear weapons, or he's developing them. And
he has nuclear weapons. He's developing intercontinental ballistic missiles.
He's developing delivery systems that, if he's successful, could reach Pearl Harbor or even the West Coast. They can already reach Japan and some American bases in the Pacific. And so it's really kind of pulp fiction stuff, except it's not fiction.
Yeah. David, New York Times has kept a list. Apparently, Kim has ordered the executions of 340 people since he came to power in 2011.
Including his uncle.
Including his uncle, Jang Sung-tak, who was executed like several others have been executed with an anti-aircraft gun. It's beyond a horror movie.
So North Korea is a kind of cross between the worst of Stalin's Soviet Union and a kind of medieval royal court. This is a hereditary Stalinist dictatorship. Kim Jong-un, the current dictator, is the grandson of the founder of the regime, the son of the second dictator. And the man who was killed in Kuala Lumpur is his older half-brother, who, it's important to note, was not just a kind of rackety kind of playboy, which he was, but he was also something of a protege of the Chinese.
Mm.
The Chinese bankroll and prop up the North Korean regime, not because they particularly love the North Korean regime, but because they don't want to lose North Korea as a buffer state between China and South Korea and all those American troops and Western forces in South Korea. So the poor, benighted people of North Korea basically live in what is a kind of buffer zone that the Chinese are willing to keep going, to keep them separate from American troops. So it really matters, because the only hope that most diplomats have for trying to curb those very dangerous nuclear ambitions of the North Korean dictator is that China may put more pressure on the North Koreans, because the Chinese do keep them alive with fuel and food and resources. But China's control over North Korea is not at all total. And the guy who just got murdered was China's best friend in the North Korean kind of setup, and they'd subsidized him and propped him up for a while. So this was partly the new dictator of North Korea pushing the Chinese to one side.
All right. That's fascinating, and that's all the time we have. Joining us today were David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor at National Journal. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Barbara Slavin, acting director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. Thanks for listening.